Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. That is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as a righteous man when God spoke well of his offerings. And by faith, he still speaks, even though he is dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. By faith, Noah, when he was warned about the things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in a promised land, like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him in the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, the city whose architect and builder is God. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered himself faithful who made the promise. And so, from this one man, and he is as good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as countless as the sands on the seashore. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And they admitted that they were aliens and strangers on the earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they'd been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abram reasoned that God would raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. By faith, Moses' parents hid him from 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not be touched and would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry ground. But when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after the people had marched around them for 7 days. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell you about Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured and refused to be released so they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned, they were sawed in two, they were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts, mountains, and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith. Yet none of them received what was promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect.
G'day. We're slowly drifting back in after the summer vacation. It's good to see it slightly fuller. Just got to walk up Mount Baker, not all the way to the peak, but for the first time yesterday. Been wanting to do that ever since we came to Canada. Gosh, it was beautiful. Just beautiful. Summer's been terrific. Apparently you can only get to Mount Baker for 2 months of the year. Well, Hebrews chapter 13 is probably the most famous part of Hebrews, if any part is. As we just heard, of course, it's the list of those people who have lived from the Old Testament as an example of faith. And most people perhaps don't know much about Hebrews, but are familiar a little bit that that's what chapter 11 does. Who kind of is a little bit familiar with chapter 11? Yeah. Just to remind ourselves where we've come from, it's a community that is missing Christ because they're becoming enamored too much with the Jewish traditions. So priesthood, temple, sacrifice, Moses, Joshua, all that stuff is taking their attention. You'll remember this, and they're being swayed from Christ. And what happens, and this is important, that in chapter 10, just before chapter 11, we learn something else about this community. They're starting to be persecuted. Not the most serious persecution that we read about in the New Testament, but it is starting. And we'll see it in chapter 13 as well. So there are two issues. And what our author has said all the way up to chapter 11, so far up to chapter 11, he said, Jesus is better than all this Jewish stuff that you're focusing on. Don't miss the real thing. Jesus is better. And we all know that. We've heard that. Now he takes a turn of thought in chapter 11. Something different occurs now. This is what he does in chapter 11. It's a new thought. He gives us a list. A list of people from the Old Testament who persevered in faith for these people, his readers, to be encouraged by. And of course, we can understand why it would be significant for his original readers, because they are enamored with the Old Testament. They are completely taken up with Old Testament things. So when he shows these Old Testament people of faith, needless to say, it's going to be very significant for them. So that's where we're going. Now, will you just turn with me to the verse just after chapter 11? Chapter 12, verse 1. Of course, here is another verse that you'll know well. This is another famous one from Hebrews. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Who knows that verse, that phrase? Since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. And I'll be honest here, for most of my life, I didn't really understand exactly what it was talking about. I don't know about you, but for most of my life, I've understood it as me as a Christian, or us as Christians, being surrounded by those great saints of the Old Testament, of old, watching us and cheering us on and praying for us. Is that the way that you've understood it? In other words, as if we're running around a racetrack, running the race, and in the gallery there is all the saints of old witnessing us as we race. But what we learn from chapter 11 is the metaphor is different. Their witness isn't them watching us. It's not them in the heavenlies watching us in our Christian walk. It's the opposite. As we'll see in chapter 11, it's their lives, their Christian lives being a witness to us, or their Old Testament lives being a witness to us of what a faithful life can look like. And I take it, too, that this list of faithful lives is an invitation to add some more biographies and to add some contemporary ones. So we'll do that this morning. And just after I speak, Mabel Ralcomo is going to add another biography of someone that is a woman that's inspired her. And I'll just say this too, as we get into it, that I think that Hebrews 11 is just as relevant today as in the first century. Because I think the reality is all of us from time to time have doubts. And particularly in hard times, it can be hard to have faith. And sometimes we're plagued by doubts all our lives. And we're going to talk about more about that. But I think that this is very, very relevant today. And I hope that you are surprised by this chapter. Let's dive in now. The first thing at the beginning of the chapter, you'll recognize the verse. It's a well-known verse, verse 1 of chapter 11. He starts to define faith for us. Would you have a look with me at the first verse? He starts to define faith. Let's see what we learn. He's defining faith all the way through the chapters, really. Verse 1 and 2, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. So the first thing we can pull out of that is this, as we try and work out what exactly is faith, it has to do with not seeing. It's knowing what we don't see with our eye. And that's very interesting. And verse 3 says it a slightly different way, but it says the same thing. If you have a look at verse 3, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. In other words, the things we see is made by God who we don't see. So you can have a look there at the screen. As we begin to define faith, not seeing it is a part of it. And I find this quote by Matthew Henry, who lived at a time where there were many martyrs who were dying in faith, the 1600s in England. Very, very serious time to be a Christian. He wrote, faith proves to the mind the reality of things that cannot be seen by bodily eyes. In other words, you and I with faith, we're not like Thomas in John chapter 20. We can't put our fingers in Jesus' crucified side, but we believe. We have faith without seeing. And it's very interesting there in John 20 where Jesus says, blessed are they who believe and yet don't see. Blessed are they who don't see and yet believe. And he's talking about us. There's something very special about believing, about having faith and not seeing. And I think we'll start to understand the richness of that from some of these biographies in a minute. And it's probably worth just making the point here, as we leave this point of not seeing, that many of us are sitting here thinking, well, isn't that exactly the problem? I'm called to believe, but I can't see. Isn't that just the problem and what's at the heart of my doubt? I don't actually see, but I'm called to believe. And I think it's just interesting to see how the chapter starts to chip away at that and show it, the ways in God's good purposes, that that's actually quite beautiful. But now let's go to the next point. As we define faith, not seeing, and now second, faith is to do with hope. And this is very, very deep. Faith is to do with hope. We'll notice it first of all in verse 2, if you can just have a quick look again. Sorry, verse 1 of Hebrews 11. Faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. And it's to do with hope. And we're talking about the future, right? Hoping what God will achieve in the future. Now let's turn to the end of the chapter, verse 39. The chapter's bracketed with these statements. Verse 39, all these witnesses were commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. So we're talking about the future. We're talking about the promises of God, what he will do, what he will secure for the world in the future. This is very, very significant. So let's get a bit deeper here. We're talking about faith having to do with hope. These Old Testament people of God, this is what hope looked like. That Yahweh, the God of Israel, would do for Israel and through Israel for the whole world what he promised. That he would turn the world upside down and make the world the kind of place that God wants it to be, especially a place where every person thrives, especially the vulnerable. And for the Christian, we express hope through Christ. That what God the Father of the Lord Jesus Christ began in raising Christ from the dead, he will soon do for the whole world, a renewed world, no more tears. Now we see with our eyes. I'm very interested in this topic of the Christian hope that comes out here in Hebrews 11. I think I shared with you before what Leslie Newbegin said. He was a missionary 19 years in India, and he was taking language lessons with a Hindi teacher. And as he spoke to this Hindi teacher, a national of India, he realized that Tamil has no word for hope. Because in India, what will be, will be. The idea that God has anchored a future for the world in Christ's resurrection is quite foreign. And as Newbegin realized this, he made another switch, that there's no word for hope, for the Christian hope anyway, in English. And it's right when you think about it. Hope in English, the English word hope, is kind of a desire for what may or may not be, isn't it? The two great hopes of Vancouver residents. I hope that the Canucks win this week. It will depend on how Luongo goes. And I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow. And it's a hope of what may or may not be. And that's what the English word hope means. So the Christian hope that God has anchored a future for his world in the resurrection of Christ, he's secured it there, is radically countercultural, and it's beautiful. And when we talk about Christian faith, that's what we're talking about. Let me just illustrate that further, because hope is so at the center of this chapter. A beautiful story, again, I think I could have shared it with you, but it's in South Africa and the Bakwena people. And the Bakwena people had been kicked off their land in about 1919. They were kicked off their land by the apartheid government. And then they had the tenacity to buy up two large farms. And now in the 1960s, 400 families lived here in Magopa, the Bakwena people. And they'd been incredibly resilient. And they'd built a high school and elementary schools and a clinic. And it was a safe place where their families could thrive. And in the 1960s, the apartheid government threatened to remove them from there. And they were systematically bulldozing down these wonderful homes. So Desmond Tutu tells a story of standing on the hill overlooking Magopa. He says the usual suspects were there, the usual advocates against apartheid. And they were praying about this town. But houses were being bulldozed systematically. And the government had now given the Bakwena people just 10 days to leave. And it was looking hopeless. And Desmond Tutu said they were dispirited, these advocates, as they stood there and prayed. And then an old man from Magopa prayed, God, we know that you are with us. Thank you for loving us. And I share this story, I suppose, because this chapter is an invitation to look, I think, at other biographies of people of faith. And Desmond Tutu said, we couldn't imagine how this man had the faith to pray that prayer. But the next day, the bulldozers didn't come. And for months, the bulldozers didn't come, and the Bakwena people even started to rebuild their houses. And then after 7 months, the bulldozers came, and knocked down, and the Bakwena people were evicted from their land. Martin Luther King Jr., the great civil rights activist in America, says this, and it's an expression of hope. This is the best expression of hope I've heard, I think. The arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. The arc of the universe is long refers to the frustration, the disappointments, the evictions, but it bends towards justice. And Desmond Tutu shared that the Mogopa people continued to petition for their land back, and in 1994, the Restitution of Land Rights Act, the Bakwena people were brought back to Mogopa. They were among the first of any of the communities in South Africa to return home in 1994. And Desmond Tutu says the old man was right. The Christian hope that in the resurrection of Christ, he has secured a future for this world. So now let's sharpen from this chapter, Hebrews chapter 11, what faith is. But first, can I say three things that faith isn't? And I think that today, especially outside the church, but also in the church, these are three things that, for the most part, people think that faith is. This is the most common one. Number one. So here's three things that faith is not. Number one, and just an ungrounded, vague, personal belief that there is a God. And I think that this is the way that Canadian society looks at Christians. And so people say, I don't have faith. Well, I have faith. And I think when people say, faith is just a crutch, this is the kind of faith they're talking about. It's kind of a bit of a wish, a bit of a prayer. People choose to have, I suppose, non-grounded intellectually, faith that God exists. And that's probably the most common view of faith. The second one that's more and more common today in Canada and Australia is a belief in the supernatural, the New Age movement, tarot cards, looking at stars. I have faith that there's something more than what we just see. And then the third one, and this is the third one's only in the church really, in some traditions, particularly certain Pentecostal traditions, faith can be that you've got to have enough faith that this person will get better. A kind of a psychological certainty that a person will be healed. If you pray with enough certainty that this person will be healed, they'll get better. And that's the way that faith is viewed and I suppose construed sometimes in certain traditions of the Christian church. I think it's very important then from Hebrews chapter 11 to be very sharp with our definition of faith. And we'll see from Hebrews chapter 11 that it's very beautiful. If we could grab the next four dot points. So now what faith is, according to Hebrews 11. Would you just have a look now, once again, at Hebrews 11, and notice how it tells the biblical story. This is the first thing that faith is. In verse 4, we have the faith of Abel. In verse 5, the faith of Enoch. Then Noah in verse 7. And then 8, at some length, the faith of Abraham. And then we go to the faith of Joseph and Moses, verse 23, at length. And now we enter the land. In verse 30, the walls of Jericho fall. Do you see how it's tracing the biblical story? And then there's a list of people going all the way up to King David. And then really, in verse 39, we get to Christ. And do you see, this is very, very significant. Faith isn't just pulled out of thin air for any of these people. Faith isn't just something that they're just called to have wishfully. Faith is knowing that the true story of the world is God restoring the world by calling a people. And through the story of the Old Testament and then the story of Israel trying to be magnetic, calling the nations to herself by her holiness, and then ultimately to Christ, and then Christ calling a church. So that faith is you and I knowing what the true story of the world is, and that we're called to play a part in it. That is very different from wishful thinking. The true story of the world. That's what Hebrews 11 speaks about faith. Now here is the second thing, and this is very interesting too. Biblical faith is about people encountering God. So have a look, for example, at Abraham in verse 11, in verse 8 there, by faith. In verse 11, Abraham, when he was called to go to a place, He encountered God and God called him. And then if you skip to verse 29, you've got the crossing of the Red Sea and the whole nation of Israel encountering God. The walls of Jericho falling in verse 30. And it's interesting to think through this idea of encountering God when we come to, say, verse 37. And people who are not only persecuted, but die for their faith. But somehow I think we're to think that this isn't just wishful thinking, but these people who are dying for their faith have really encountered Yahweh, the God of Israel. So second, biblical faith is encountering God. And then third from Hebrews chapter 11, I think it's probably easy to miss in a way, that biblical faith can doubt. And just to say, I think biblical faith can doubt precisely because it's not just wishful thinking. It's not just pulled out of thin air. Biblical faith can doubt precisely because it's through a God, it's faith in a God who's acting in history. It's faith in a God who we've encountered. Biblical faith can doubt. And in preparing this sermon, I read a quote by an Australian scholar who gave a list of names from the Old Testament of people who had faith, but it was a doubting faith. And I noticed that most of these names are here in Hebrews 11. Have a listen to what Michael Jensen writes about faith and doubting. He says, the Bible's great characters are doubters. Abraham, whose belief in the promises of God were the merest threat at times. Moses, who argued and pleaded with God. David, who sank in his own sins. And who, as the psalmist, King David, wrestled with God's apparent absence. The apostle Peter, who sank beneath the waves and betrayed the Lord. And even, interestingly, Jesus at Gethsemane does not appear as a superman of faith, but rather as a man in the grip of real existential terror. Now, just to prove that I'm not getting this out of thin air, but that doubt really is here in Hebrews chapter 11, but not explicitly, what's the first thing, and you can answer this, what's the first thing that you think of when you think of Abraham's wife, Sarai? What's the first thing you think of when you think of Sarai in terms of narrative and story? Sorry? She doubts, yeah. Anything else you remember? What else? She laughed? Yeah, she laughed when God promised Abraham and her a son. She laughed, didn't she? And Abraham's here in chapter 11, right here in verse 11. And any reader who knows their Old Testament, particularly these people that this book's written to, who know their Old Testament very well, obviously, because they love the Old Testament and its faith, they would know that story. And one whiff of the name Sarah, and they're thinking, okay, faith can doubt as well. And I find that very encouraging. Now, number four, just to reiterate, as we're defining biblical faith has to do with hope, that Christ has secured, he's anchored a future back there in his resurrection in 33 AD. A future for the world is anchored there. Well, before we go on into our text in Hebrews 11, let me just share a biography of a man who's strengthened my faith, a hero of the faith for me. I don't know him well at all. I only met him 2 months ago, actually. His name is Palmer Robinson, and he's the director and principal of African Bible College, Uganda. He actually started the Bible College. He's an Old Testament scholar, and he's given his life to Africa. He lives there. I met him in the UK, in England, where I was. We were there for a conference. And just to set the picture, there's about 25 people in the room, and Palmer Robinson is giving a paper as an Old Testament scholar on Ecclesiastes. And I'm sitting next to my friends there. And what's nice is I got to have breakfast with Palmer Robinson that morning. And he did a paper for an hour on the book of Ecclesiastes. And the background is that Old Testament scholarship is largely done. The most famous people in Old Testament scholarship probably aren't really Christians. They don't take the Bible seriously. They don't believe the God of Israel is God at all. They certainly... Many Old Testament scholars wouldn't believe in the resurrection of Christ. So that's the context. Well, Palmer Robinson, as a senior man, maybe 70 years old, He spoke on Ecclesiastes like a man who had encountered the God of Israel. That point two there. He knew the God he was talking about. And as he spoke on Ecclesiastes, it was a paper with an entirely different kind of tone to what you would usually encounter in an Old Testament conference. And at the end, a friend of mine, another Old Testament scholar, said to me, "You know, it wasn't a great paper, was it?" He didn't really back up his arguments very well. He didn't really use the text all that well. And I probably granted, it may not have been one of Palmer Robbins's finest papers. But I said, I love his faith. And he's showing me what any biblical scholarship is all about. This guy has encountered God. He's there in Africa because he's encountered God. And he reads the Bible knowing the reality of the God who is speaking in the Old Testament, the God who speaks in Scripture. So there's a man who's been a hero of the faith to me recently. Well, let's just briefly, we're not going to have time by any means to walk through all of Hebrews chapter 11. Don't worry. But just very briefly, let me just touch base on a couple of the characters. The first person we meet, if you just skim along with me, if you don't mind, is Abel. And of course, we meet him. What chapter of Genesis does Abel come along? Does anyone know? Yeah, well done. Four. Yeah, let's give it up. That was wonderful. Yeah, clap. Let's go. Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting what is said about Abel. It's by faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain did. It's interesting how his description ends. By faith, he still speaks. So his walking in faith with Yahweh, the God of Israel, still speaks to us. He's a witness to us. And then verse 5, Enoch is interesting. Does anyone know what chapter of Genesis Enoch comes? Chapter 5. But he's interesting because it says twice in Genesis chapter 5. He only gets two verses, but it says Enoch walked with God, and then it says, and he was no more. And so tradition has it, he didn't die like Elijah. He was taken up. And so here's an example of faith here, verse 5. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he didn't experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. Before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God and so on. But let's just bed down, just for a little bit longer, but not too long, in Abraham as an example of faith. And just to give you the background, of course, if you have a look at the map, we learn that Abraham was born, Genesis chapter 11, in Ur. There at the beginning of that red line. And just to give you some archaeology, Ur is very well known by ancient historians. If you're a history teacher here, you'll know Ur. Ur is the first place that writing was invented. Writing was invented in Ur. So this is no fanciful kind of history remaking in the Bible. Ur of the Chaldees. And he was called by God to leave this advanced city and to travel all the way to Palestine. And what we're going to read in verse 8 is this very significant point as we think about people of faith, is Palestine belonged to someone else. It belonged to other kings. It belonged to other people. So Abraham was a nomad. He lived in tents. So let's just have a look here at verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called to go to a place he would later receive as an inheritance, he obeyed and went, even though he didn't know where he was going. And verse 9 is just going to explain some of the difficulties for Abraham. He did live as a nomad. He did live in tents. We know from Genesis some of the things that happened. He had to make treaties to get a well, to get access to water. He had to make treaties with kings. It was hard going. You read, actually, interestingly, in Genesis chapter 12, how during a famine he had to go down to Egypt, and then Pharaoh took Sarai, his wife, for his harem. Remember that story? So this act of faith was hard work. Genesis chapter 20, we meet there in Palestine, in the land that Abraham had a promise that he would inherit sometime, but it belonged to the king Abimelech. And King Abimelech takes Abraham's wife as well at that point for his harem. And both times, Yahweh brings Abraham's wife back safely. So this is what's going on in verse 9. Now, in the light of this, living in a land that wasn't his, but promised by God that it would be his soon. In other words, a life of faith, a life of hope, that God would do what he said. Have a look at verse 10. I'm fascinated by verse 10. I love it, actually. For he was looking forward to the city. This is a bit I love. To the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And I just think of the way that that phrase, the city with foundations, resounds. Let's take that seriously, that phrase. I mean, in a sense, if it's talking about the Old Testament, it's talking about perhaps Jerusalem. There's echoes of Jerusalem there. Jerusalem, as good as it should be, not with all the sin and muck and injustice that ended up in it. But that city with foundations, isn't that speaking about the renewed world, the new creation, where Christ will return and fix our cities and make them cities with foundations? He'll beautify them and make them rock solid. I love that. The area where I used to live 12 months ago before we came to Canada was the Mount Druitt area, and it was a poverty area. We had a very high indigenous population, one of the most high, the second most high in Australia. And I was just, it used to rip me apart that the current generation of indigenous kids in my community, they weren't even getting to school. They weren't even starting school when they were five. Weren't even starting. And we used to try and do stuff as a church. We were trying to do stuff. But, you know, the problem was so big. And I walk around Langley and I see homelessness. And I see our churches just trying to wake up. And I see myself just trying to wake up. And I think of our cities. And this phrase, a city with foundations. A city that Christ will build. Renewing Langley, renewing Vancouver, renewing Mount Druitt, so that the vulnerable thrive, so that Christ is honoured in the beauty of life, so that Christ is seen with our eye. A city with foundations. Do you like that phrase? We're going to skip a whole lot of characters now, but I'd like to turn to the end of the chapter, if you would, to chapter 37, as we're thinking about faith and hope, because the chapter ends with the persecuted church of the Old Testament. Starts with Abraham, who lived an okay life, goes to Moses, who lived a tough life. But it finishes with the persecuted church. And it's interesting to think about faith and hope with these people, because they didn't see it in their lifetime. Unlike the residents of Mogopa, they didn't see it in their lifetime. Have a look at verse 37. Oh, let's go from verse 36. Some faced jeers and flogging, while others were chained and put in prison. First person that comes to mind is the Apostle Paul. In 2 Corinthians, he speaks, 3 times I was whipped, 5 times beaten with rods. And then verse 37, they were stoned. Makes me think of Stephen in Acts 7. They were sawn in two. And by Jewish tradition, that's the prophet Isaiah, who was sawn in two. They were put to death by the sword. Perhaps James, a brother of Jesus. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, perhaps Elijah and Elisha, destitute, persecuted, mistreated. And how about 38? The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and in holes in the ground. Faith and hope that Christ in his resurrection has secured a future for the world. And so in Christ, I can not only live, but also die in his name. Can I read you a biography of a contemporary Christian martyr, a contemporary Christian witness, rather. I don't know that he has been martyred, who's been inspiring to me. A Maasai warrior named Joseph, and he told this story at a Billy Graham conference for itinerant evangelisms. And Joseph, he met an evangelist who explained to him the gospel, and Joseph, having the gospel explained, was convicted and converted on the spot. And Joseph desired to tell his own community what he's learned. He was so excited about the gospel, so excited about Christ who had died for sinners, Christ who had died for the world. He went into his village, busting to tell. To his amazement, as he told them about Christ, they were enraged. The men grabbed him, pinned him down, And the women beat him with barbed wire and threw him out of the village. Joseph didn't wake up for a day or two. When he woke up, he was delirious. He was miraculously protected from the animals. He found water, and somehow he survived. He processed what had happened and concluded, I must have said it wrong. So he went over in his mind again what the evangelist had told him about forgiveness of sins and the cross and the resurrection and Christ's love. I must have got it wrong. No one would respond to Jesus in this way. So he went back again into the village. And the same thing happened. The men held him down and they beat him and reopened old wounds. And if the first time it was remarkable that he survived, the second time it was miraculous. And when he woke up from his delirium, the second time, this time more sober to what was going on, he decided to go back. And this time, the third time, they did it again. They beat him. Only with one difference this third time. As he was going unconscious from the beatings with barbed wire, he saw tears in their eyes. And instead of waking up next to the waterhole outside of town this time, he woke up in his own bed with people around him struggling to keep him alive. And he found that the whole town had turned to Christ. The world was not worthy of them. It says in verse 38, and so may we live as people of faith. Well, friends, we're going to stand and sing a beautiful old testimony to the gospel, one that I grew up with and probably many of us did. So let's stand now and sing, For God Forgave My Sin.